In April and May at Hillcrest Church in Austin, we held a special series of interviews. We called our event the Neighboring Faiths Interviews. We invited the leaders of four major religions to come for an interview regarding their faith background. I got a chance to build friendship with a Jewish rabbi and a Muslim imam, a Hindu priest, and a Buddhist monk. Now, you likely work with Hindu co-workers or have a Muslim family on your street, or your kids play soccer with kids from Jewish families. And the whole reason for our interview series was to help us learn to be two things at once, good neighbors and good communicators in our diverse city. We're to be good neighbors. Everything I read in Scripture tells me that I am to seek my neighbor's good, and I'm to seek his good regardless of whether he converts to Christianity or even wants to hear about it. So I'm to be a good neighbor, but at the same time, I'm to be a good communicator. Opportunities often arise in our relationships with others to explain how Jesus can be our forgiver and leader. So, good neighbors, good communicators, that's who we're supposed to be, not just one or the other, but both at the same time. And neither is possible without understanding. You know, I read that the Chinese written character for wisdom is made up of two Chinese characters, one an image of a large ear and the other a small mouth. Don't you love that? Wisdom comes from listening more than yakking, in other words. Well, our Neighboring Faiths interviews were all about learning to have a big ear and a small mouth. The event wasn't meant to be a time of debate. It was meant to be a time of listening, all for the hope that we can be better neighbors and better communicators. At the end of the following interview, pay attention. There are some resources that I'm going to recommend to help you learn more about other faiths. And these materials will also help you communicate your faith in Jesus when an opportunity arises. Thanks for your interest in the Neighboring Faiths interviews. And then right at this time, what I wanted you to do is welcome as our guest tonight, Girish Chaitanya.
How do you know? All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Now, there's a new book out by Stephen Prothero. He is a religion professor at Boston University, and he introduces various faiths, some of which we've had a chance to look at. And he said something I thought very interesting, very appropriate, and very beautiful about Hinduism. He said, "Hinduism is an over-the-top religion of big ideas, bright colors, soulful mantras, spicy foods, complex rituals, and wild stories." And I think you would probably agree with generally that one sentence summary of Hinduism, right? We were talking earlier and I said, now, this is going to be a challenge, isn't it, to cover about 4,000 years of Hinduism in about 1 hour's time. But we should get started right away, right? Hinduism is the oldest of the world's religions, by the way, and, it's the third, in terms of numbers of adherents, is the third largest, after Christianity and Islam, roughly 900 million followers around the world. Locally here in Austin, about 12,000 to 16,000 Indians, most of whom are Hindu, seven temples in our area. And of course, your temple is, where you serve is the Chinmaya Mission in Round Rock, north of us here. So first of all, tell us, you were an engineer in the San Francisco area for, if I recall, about 15 years and, got out of the business world, felt that you could best serve as a Hindu priest. So tell us about that transfer from the business world into this walk of life that you're in now.
Absolutely. Again, Brahmachari Girish Chaitanya is my name. Brahmachari is a title given to Hindu monks in training. We have to have this title for about 12 years before we are bestowed upon complete monkhood. It's been about 8 years since I've had these robes. I was born in India, came to the United States when I was 13 years old, finished my high school, went on to college, went to Purdue, University of California, Davis, finished my electrical engineering, then went to UC Berkeley, studied Sanskrit over there. And like all Indian parents, they wanted me to become a doctor. So I told them, no, I would like to be in engineering, but my passion is religion and theology. So I studied Sanskrit at Berkeley, and I wanted to get a view as to how people live in this world, a window into real life. So I worked in Silicon Valley for about 13 years. I worked as a hardware design engineer with motion control engineering, and I thoroughly enjoyed my job. I had the coolest job. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Designed elevator controllers for various things. Some famous things that I've worked on are the Statue of Liberty, Washington Monument. So got a chance to go over there, install. I had great time. But underneath, I always had passion for the human life and what life meant and what the purpose in human life was and is. While I was in college, my roommate, in my freshman year, he used to go to Bible study classes, and he used to tell me, you know, you're just sitting over here doing nothing on Fridays, why don't you come to Bible study with me? So I said, you know what, John, you're absolutely right, I'll come with you. So I went with him, and I studied Bible, and at the end of the first year, I was thinking, you know, I have pretty decent understanding of what's in Luke and John and Matthew and all these things, but I really don't know what's in Bhagavad Gita, and I ought to take some time to learn. So that is what created this curiosity in me to learn Sanskrit, mainly to study Bhagavad Gita, and that is what brought me to Berkeley to study Sanskrit. Then I studied with a monk. I studied Eastern theology throughout these 13 years that I was working. And eventually, after 10 years or so, I said, okay, now is the time when I really have to take the step and truly devote my life to this cause that I have great passion for. So in 2000, I pretty much decided that I wanted to leave my career as an engineer, and I embarked upon this journey to become a monk. I went to India, entered a monastery, studied in the Hindu seminary for 2.5 years, then roamed about in the Himalayas and various other places. And upon doing what I've always wanted to do, my teacher told me, well, now you can go back to the United States and start teaching in our monasteries over there. Initially, I did not want to come back to U.S. I thoroughly enjoyed the Himalayas so much. I wanted to just stay in our monasteries over there. So he says, no, you know English. You have a rapport with kids growing up over there. So you would be the right person to teach Hinduism. So that's what brought me to our Los Angeles monastery.
Yeah. And then the Chinmaya mission about a year and a half ago. Now, Girish mentioned Sanskrit, which is a language that is especially shows up in a number of the Hindu scriptures.
Yeah.
And the Bhagavad Gita is one story or one portion of a vast measure of Hindu scriptures. Now, what I thought might be helpful as far as just sort of to, an entry point into trying to understand Hinduism from this gathering, which is predominantly Western audiences, to just throw out in no particular order some random things that serve as, I guess, points of entry into Indian culture, generally Hinduism in specific.
Sure.
It may surprise this gathering that we've probably been introduced as a Western culture to Hinduism more than we're aware of. I mean, Oprah Winfrey encouraging everyone to study Eckhart Tolle's book, A New Earth, last year or the year before, basically a westernized version of Hinduism. If any of you have seen all or even part of the Star Wars saga, you know a little bit about sort of the Hindu theology that comes through on that. Maybe you weren't aware of that. Of course, Jim Henson and his Muppets, the Muppet Show, probably didn't have too much Hinduism in it, but the Dark Crystal and Fraggle Rock, which was some things that were popular, kind of dating me at this point to mention a couple of those, but that was just very explicit Hindu theology that was in there. And of course, George Harrison with the Beatles and his song My Sweet Lord, introducing the phrase Hare Krishna to a Western audience. And then if you are a bit more of a scholar, Karen Armstrong, and particularly Houston Smith, with their studies of world religions, basically have largely a Hindu approach to understanding world religions, as opposed to perhaps somebody like a Stephen Prothero in Boston University. But there are some touchstones that should serve as entry points. For example, the practice of yoga. Now, in the Western world, yoga is looked upon largely as predominantly a physical discipline. Of course, the word yoga means discipline.
Correct.
But there are religious dimensions to it as well. I think I told you when you and I were visiting, yeah, and I can't remember where it was. I'm assuming Southern California, but a group had been leading out in yoga and practicing yoga, and the local area decided that, well, if this is simply a physical practice, then we are going to tax your classes just as we tax, you know, gymnasiums and that kind of thing. And suddenly they said, oh, it's not a physical practice, it's a religious practice. And I thought, well, that may be a cynical way of avoiding taxation, but what is it? I imagine the answer is both, right? Physical,
yeah,
and spiritual.
Yoga is a very ancient technique developed by Hindu masters early on to realize that there is a connection between the physical and the subtle world. The physical world that we live in, our physical body greets this physical world. And in order for this body to live in harmony in this physical world, it can enjoy the very materials born out of this world, provided it retains its health. So the literal meaning of the word yoga is yunj, to unite. Mm. To unite various things. At a superficial level, we are uniting this human body to a type of health which, endowed with, it can enjoy the physical world. The product of which will be a more inner, calm personality which will be able to evolve spiritually. So the whole purpose of yoga is to create a placid, quiet, tranquil mind, so that that mind can take on to the journey towards the higher, to realize the very essence of what a human experience is supposed to be.
That's a very tight summary of a very ancient practice. One question I'd say would say Westerners have who have no background in Hinduism is the Aryan swastika that shows up in Hindu culture. When I was delivering newsletters in my neighborhood, I have a role in my neighborhood, and had some Indian neighbors, some Hindu neighbors, and saw the swastika over the door. And I said, now I know that that's not a reference to Nazism,
correct,
but it's a reference to, you know, religious,
yeah,
and it is background in Aryanism, but help us understand that. It's not advocating Nazism, but what is it?
What is the Aryan
swastika all about?
Swastika, the word swasti, literally means swa and asti. Asti meaning existence. And swasti meaning that existence which is so profound. Mm-hmm. And the very two lines which are intersecting one another is symbolizing the union of that existence from various sides reaching the same center. Mm-hmm. That is the literal meaning of swastika.
Okay.
That in entire creation, we all seek harmony, which is the center. No matter where lines come from, the union is one point. And Hitler took that, and he has revolved it 45 degrees. So if you see that swastika at a 45-degree angle, and that is the symbol that the Nazis, yeah, used. But he was actually a scholar in Sanskrit. Mm. He had studied a lot of Indian theology and philosophy, and he practiced it. Yeah.
And our introduction to the swastika is Nazism, but it's much older than Nazism. So.
Even, you know, he was a vegetarian. I mean, who would have known all those things? So, but, you know, somehow the interpretation, it didn't gel with him. Yeah. But he really had studied Hinduism. In fact, even today, if we want to study some of the greatest books in Hinduism, we have to actually go to Germany, because they were all taken to Germany.
Mm. Now, another point of entry I think Westerners have are the images or designs on the forehead, the markings.
Right.
You and I talked about that when we were
Correct.
Together earlier as well. depending on the direction of the line, vertical or horizontal. Right. It symbolizes different, I guess, philosophies the person adheres to. Is that right?
Yeah. That's the beauty about Hinduism. It's a fest of all philosophers getting together, trying to understand the simple principle of existence and truth. The lineage that I come from is the very highest order of Vedas, known as non-dualism, without going into too much technicalities. And basically what that means is truth alone exists, and in case if creation exists, creation is only going to be reduced to ash. Thus, the assertion of truth and reduction of creation to ash, and that is what the symbol which is on my forehead stands for, and that is for a non-dual practicing Advaita philosophy of Hinduism. But there are so many of them. The Shaivites, they were the three lines which represents the three types of bodies, the gross body, the subtle body, and the causal body, which are all going to be reduced to ashes. It also means the three experiences of a human being, the waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state. Even those are resolved into ash at the end of the human life. And so these are some of the symbols behind it. For the Vaishnav cult, which believes in the existence of the Supreme Being as Vishnu or Krishna, they take a sandal paste and they make a U marking on the forehead, symbolizing that there is a great harmony between the creation and the creator, and the union of it keeps the entire world alive. Only when there is matter and spirit coming in union. So there are so many symbols that people wear, but this is basically what mine is.
Now, another point of entry, I would suppose, would be the holidays, particularly Diwali and Holi. Mm-hmm. And of course, most of us we get our understanding of world religions through our pop culture, you know, like The Simpsons or NBC's The Office, where Kelly, you know, is from an Indian background on The Office, and a few seasons of course, Kelly was invited the Office gang over to a Diwali ceremony, and Ed Helms put together the Diwali song, which was a playoff of the Hanukkah song. And I dare you to put that many pop culture references in 15 seconds like I just did. But Diwali, right after the New Year, and Holi, which I suppose is a spring festival. Tell us quickly about...
Usually Diwali in North India falls around the New Year for North Indians. In different region of India, we have different calendars, different solar calendars, lunar calendars, and as per one's adherence to one particular calendar, they celebrate various festivals. Diwali happens to fall somewhere in the fall season. And it is the harvest festival. That monsoon season is over in India around September. Grains have yielded a pretty decent crop, and it is giving thanks to the Supreme Lord, which is where even in United States we see Thanksgiving fall around the same time. So it is sort of, you know, equivalent to that Thanksgiving, where people truly are thankful for what they have. There are so many different meanings of Diwali. Diwali also is a festival which celebrates the destruction of complete ignorance and the awakening of a human soul into the divinity.
That's the reference to light.
That is the reference to light, exactly. Okay. So there is a festival of light, where a light of lamp or a light of knowledge is lit, and that destroys the darkness of ignorance. Diwali is also a victory over Lord Rama, who conquered this great demon, which is a symbolic representation that each one of us has a demon within, but only endowed with deeper, profound virtues one can conquer one's own inner demons. So that is another reference to Diwali. So we have so many different festivals. We have both spiritual meaning as well as ritualistic meaning as well as cultural meaning. Okay. And it's all intertwined. It's a fest of, you know, the religion and culture is so intertwined that we really cannot separate them.
Now, Holi, I think, made the front page of the Daily Texan a few months ago, or a few weeks ago. I've lost track. And
a month ago.
A very colorful celebration.
Yeah. That is a celebration of spring, the arrival of spring, the arrival of various colors. And that only shows various colors that we have in our own mind. But actually, each one of these colors, they spring forth from one hand which sprinkles so many colors. In the same way, it is one being seeing various colors out there. But the unification of all these colors is one mind, one spirit.
One other that I could think of that serves as people see it, and perhaps not coming from a Hindu background, they wonder what its meaning is of course the Sanskrit symbol for the symbol for God.
God. Right. Yes.
Can you that of course you would see on perhaps many websites or many signs into, for example, the Austin Hindu Temple and so on. So that may be a point of entry for people to understand Hinduism. Help us understand the symbol for God being Om.
Absolutely. It's a sound symbol that represents the transcendental truth. Hindus believe in the supreme being, which is devoid of name, devoid of qualities. If something is beyond the description of word, how do you indicate it? Utilizing language. So this Om is made up of three syllables, A, U, and Ma, and that means all sounds are included, starting from the stomach all the way up to the point where the lip closes, which is the end of language. So it's a sound symbol that even language cannot point out to that transcendental truth. And it indicates that truth, it points to that truth, but it itself is not that truth. So that nirgun, which is devoid of gunas or qualities, is indicated by that supreme Om, and that same Om manifests in this world as various names and forms, as glory of all beings, is none other than the expression of that Om in various names and form.
That could lead us, I think, to a discussion about one's understanding of God in Christianity and in Hinduism. Mm-hmm. I mentioned Stephen Prothero earlier. He has a brand new book out. It's called God Is Not One, which I thought was a provocative title. And again, Boston University professor, and wonderful book. If this isn't out on the shelves yet, it will be next week. Publisher was kind enough to send me an advanced copy, probably in hopes of me making reference to it here, since this is being filmed as well as heard live. But I thought that this was a wonderful, succinct summary of the approach to understanding God in the various philosophies of Hinduism. He wrote, in the Western monotheisms, one is the holiest number, but Hindus worship many gods through many different paths, disciplines, and philosophies. Their deities appear as powerful kings, starving ascetics, brave monkeys, graceful dancers, blue-faced flute players, and impersonal stones. Some Hindus say that there's really just one God underlying these many manifestations. That's the approach that you'll have in just a moment. Others say that there are many gods, but one is supreme. Still others say that there are many gods and all are equal. Some Hindus even say there is no God whatsoever, that the gods are a byproduct of our hyperactive imaginations. And I thought, what a perfect summary, as I've tried to understand Hinduism. And I must say, and I think I told you this the last time that we met together in preparation for this, that after these hours of visiting with you and studying Hinduism, I may be just as confused as I was when I began. But I will say in all sincerity that this study has led me to a greater appreciation, a greater love for the Indian people than I had before, many of whom are Hindu, not all, but many. Mm-hmm. And so, but I would say perhaps, and you and I were talking just before this began, that perhaps the easiest way to kind of get our arms around this as a Western audience is, generally speaking, we can probably reduce the Hindu philosophies of God down to two, as you used the phrase just a moment ago, Brahma without form and without attributes, and God with attributes. Correct. Is that the best way to say it?
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
trying to summarize it in just 5 minutes, right?
See, in Hinduism, it's a federation of philosophers' feast. We have so many philosophers who've come up with so many different philosophies. And the beauty about Hinduism is that it accepts all philosophies, that each philosophy has to culminate into a particular thought, and that thought must have a proper thought development. If it does not have a proper thought development, then it is not considered to be one of the philosophies. So in India, there are basic six schools of philosophy, and each one of these philosophies, they culminate into the highest, which I talked about, is the non-dual philosophy. And even in the non-dual philosophy, to understand that supreme being, various philosophers have come along the march of time, and they have tried to interpret that truth, that how can I explain that to the best, in the best possible way, to the person sitting next to me without confusing them. So what happened is different people fall under different categories. And in order to explain that, what they did is, in process of explaining the highest, a person could only understand so much. So they had to end that philosophy over there. So that became one philosophy. Then they tried to explain to the second person, and that person was a little bit more evolved, the mind and the intellect a little bit subtler, so they could stretch that philosophy and take it higher. So in that way, we had six different philosophies which came out. Out of these, the highest one further is divided into even four more. And that is what makes it so confusing. But at a simple level, there is a supreme truth which exists without name, without form, without attributes, and the supreme truth which exists with name, with form, with attributes. Some people say that my relationship with this one, with name, with form, with attributes, is that it is higher, it is supreme, and I am lower. So there is a relationship between a devotee and the devoted, that Lord, versus the other one saying that there is no relationship between me and my Lord. In fact, in essence, we are one and the same.
And of course, that's where the non-dual or monism term shows up, a reference to Atman, which
correct.
Is another, I suppose, word for soul, not exactly perhaps the Christian understanding of soul, and then Brahman, which is
supreme,
the oversoul or the force beyond this life, and non-dualism or monism would teach basically that there really is no difference between myself and the oversoul. There is no difference between Atman and Brahman.
In essence, it is one.
And really, we'll get into this just in just a moment. But the problem to overcome in that school of philosophy in Hinduism is the ignorance that I am ignorant of the fact that I am one with the Supreme.
Correct.
And I need to overcome that ignorance.
Absolutely.
Which Eckhart Tolle, like I mentioned earlier, speaks quite a bit about that in his very popular book in America, A New Earth. Now, that would be God without attributes. In other words, there are no attributes that could really describe or accurately encase our understanding of Brahman or that oversoul. A lot of times when we use the word God, we're thinking in terms of our Christian worldview, in which God is a person, a being to whom we pray, a person who is responsive to us. And the reason I keep using the word Brahman instead of God is Brahman is impersonal, or beyond attributes, so
correct,
therefore beyond personhood.
Not a personal God. Mm-hmm. So that same Brahman, which is the transcendental being, that supreme soul, when it manifests in this world, all of a sudden, three things come out, which is God, the world, and the individual soul. So all philosophies in Hinduism are trying to answer what is the relationship between these three. In monism, there is no relationship. The relationship is that one being is. That supreme being, being the material cause as well as the instrumental cause, became this world. Okay. That is the monism philosophy. So that Brahman becomes God as the controller of the whole universe. So Brahman loses its status of being Brahman when it is viewed as a creator. As a creator, he becomes God. And as God, he controls the world as well as the beings which are in this world.
Now, the other view in Hinduism, and perhaps even probably on a popular level, the more widely embraced, is the God with attributes understanding.
Correct.
And this is where, of course, you get all of the stories of Krishna and Ganesha and the very vivid and lively and colorful, you know, stories that perhaps more people are familiar with if they begin to study Hinduism, which leads us to the understanding. One of the key understandings in Hinduism is the idea of avatar.
Correct.
That Krishna is an avatar of Vishnu. That Ganesha is it's supposed to be an avatar, at least a son of Shiva, and so on. So help us understand this understanding of avatar, these different appearances or incarnations of one God or another in the stories of Hinduism.
One of the tenets of Hinduism is this concept of avatar. This is unique to Hinduism. And in Hinduism, this concept of avatar is so unique. What is meant by this entire doctrine of avatar, this concept of avatar, is that the Supreme Being, in order to establish righteousness and in order to get rid of all wickedness which has come along the march of time, the being incarnates. He does not reincarnate, but he incarnates. And that incarnation is known as an avatar. And as an avatar, endowed with various powers, establishes righteousness. That is the sole purpose of an avatar. And in that way, we have the Supreme Being as Vishnu, who incarnates in so many different avatars, as Rama, as Krishna, and
Buddha.
Now,
I suppose there are some Hindus who would understand Jesus to be an avatar.
Jesus as an avatar.
Vishnu.
So all of these are, and different great, great men who have come along and established righteousness, who have brought righteousness to people, even they are considered to be avatars.
The a very popular book, it's been out for some time, called The Life of Pi.
Yeah.
Have you had a chance? You've read this, perhaps?
No, I have not read it.
It seemed to me to be a good, at least in novel format, way of communicating Hinduism and Hinduism's understanding of Islam and Christianity. And I thought this was a beautiful passage. Let me read this and see if you would say this serves as a good summary of God without form, God with attributes.
Okay.
The universe makes sense to me through Hindu eyes, Pai says. There is Brahman, the world soul, the sustaining frame upon which is woven, warp and weft, the cloth of being, with all its decorative elements of space and time. There's Brahman Nirguna, Nirguna. Without qualities, yes. Which lies beyond all understanding, beyond description, beyond approach. With our poor words, we sow a suit for it. One, truth, unity, absolute, ultimate, reality, ground of being, and try to make it fit. But Brahman, Nirguna, always bursts the seams. We're left speechless. But there's also Brahman Saguna, with qualities, where the suit fits. Now we call it Shiva, Krishna, Shakti, Ganesha. We can approach it with some understanding. We can discern certain attributes, loving, merciful, frightening, and we feel the gentle pull of relationship. Brahman Saguna is Brahman made manifest to our limited senses, Brahman expressed not only in gods but in humans, animals, trees, and a handful of earth, for everything has a trace of the divine in it. The truth of life is that Brahman is no different from Atman, the spiritual force within us, what you might call the soul. The individual soul touches upon the world soul like a well reaches for the water table. That which sustains the universe beyond thought and language, and that which is at the core of us and struggles for expression, is the same thing, the finite within the infinite, the infinite with the finite. But one thing is clear, Atman seeks to realize Brahman, to be united with the absolute, and it travels in this life on a pilgrimage where it is born and dies and born again and dies again and again and again until it manages to shed the sheaths that imprison it here below. The paths to liberation are numerous, but the bank along the way is always the same, the bank of karma, where the liberation account of each of us is credited or debited depending on our actions. This, in a holy nutshell, is Hinduism, and I have been a Hindu all my life. With its notions in mind, I see my place in the universe.
Absolutely.
Is that a pretty good description?
That's a very good description.
And we'll get in a moment to the idea of reincarnation and karma, right, that he mentions, but yeah. God without attributes, God
absolutely
with attributes, he does a pretty good job.
Anybody who's gone to a Hindu temple, you know, they'll see so many gods over there, and they become really confused. People say, well, what do you believe in Hinduism? Do you believe in so many different gods? You have so many different gods? And that's why, you know, philosophy is required to explain that without qualities has manifested with qualities. So essentially, anything with qualities can be worshipped. So out of all the things which are worthy of being worshipped, these are just a few which are placed over here. And that concept is a little bit difficult for a person who is just beginning to learn about Hinduism to digest, that it is not an idol worship, that what that idol represents is the ideal behind the idol.
Yeah.
And it is that ideal which is without qualities, without name, without form.
Well, wouldn't the majority of Hindus properly understand that the icon or statue is not just representative of, but is, in a sense, an abode of or a place of dwelling for the god that the person is honoring or worshiping? The reason I'm asking is that I had an opportunity. I haven't had a chance to go to the Chinmaya mission, but had an opportunity to go to Austin Hindu Temple for a service and had a chance to sit and be an observer. And the is it pronounced puja?
Puja, correct.
The form of worship and practice by honoring the icon. It is a way. It is honoring the god that resides in the icon. Is that a way of describing it?
At the physical level, mm-hmm, all modes of worship done to that idol, mm-hmm, is actually done to that actual god, mm-hmm, that being. But at a deeper understanding, that being and I are not different. Mm-hmm. It's me. So the entire mode of doing the puja or worship is supposed to lead me to truly discover what is that in me which is worthy of being worshipped. But very few people can make that leap, mm-hmm, make that jump. Mm-hmm. Thus, we have in Hinduism this dualistic mode of worship which is very popular. Mm-hmm. And the popular path in Hinduism is the path of devotion, mm-hmm, and devotion towards God. God who is someone who's different than me.
I think I've always heard it referred to as bhakti.
Bhakti,
Hinduism, which is a version of popular or devotional
absolutely
Hinduism. And the way that I've understood it is then that the God resides in the icon or in the vicinity of the icon as long as proper honor is being paid by means of taking care of the icon, giving attention to the icon on a regular basis.
Absolutely. Okay. Pranas, which is considered to be the vital breath which keeps this body alive, in a ritualistic fashion, they instill these pranas into the idol. And it is not just some idol, but it is a living, breathing entity. And they worship it as though the deity is right there. So that mode of worship is very common in India. But, you know, when applied philosophy to religion, then a person understands that, you know, there is a greater purpose behind it.
I heard a Hindu woman refer to one time going to temple. She was going to, is the word darshan?
Darshan.
Darshan. So the idea, which I think has the idea of being seen, not seeing the God, being seen by the God. This is the most important aspect, I think.
Correct.
In fact, when I was there, we had perhaps an hour or so where I was listening to folks singing along. I assume it was in Hindi. The songs of praise. At the conclusion, the circumnavigation of the temple began up to the front. Hmm. And I suppose this is where darshan takes place, being seen and seeing.
Correct. When one comes right in front of the idol and one bows down to the idol, actually what person does is they don't look at the idol, but actually they look at it, they close their eyes and bow down. So the true darshan, seeing, is done on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the meaning behind the darshan.
Yeah. What I've found in not only study of my faith, but the study of other faiths, other world religions, is generally religion is seeking to answer the question, what is wrong with the world and what can be done about it? Mm-hmm. And my understanding of Hinduism is the answer to the first question, what is wrong with the world, is samsara, existence and returning to existence. In other words, reincarnation.
Yeah.
Is that kind of a succinct summary of how Hinduism would approach what is wrong with the world, what our problem is, what needs to be solved is the issue of samsara or wandering in and out of existence.
Correct.
Is that right?
That's very correct. In Hinduism, we are trying to understand the relationship between the God, the individual, and that which unites the two, which is samsara. It is in samsara, the jiva or the individual soul, like you were saying, atman, that atma has fallen. And when a being comes into this world, that being is exposed to various experiences. Some joyful, some not joyful. You know, so there's always joy and happiness, sorrow and happiness. So whenever this sorrow takes over this individual being, it looks at the world and tries to understand, what is this world? Why am I feeling this way? And only in the state of sadness, a person wants to find out, what is it? And how do I get out of it? So the whole idea in Hinduism is born out of suffering of a human being. And next week, he will elaborate more upon it in the study of Buddhism, because this is where Buddhism starts, suffering. So the main idea in Hinduism about the suffering is that there is a way out. There has to be a way out. And the way out of this samsara is to understand what is samsara. And when truly a person makes an inquiry into samsara, one realizes that this world is nothing but transient. It is continuously in flux, in movement. And if something is in flux, in movement, then it is not real. It has a temporary existence. If it has temporary existence, then I must be having a permanent existence from which I'm viewing the temporary flow. So I must be someone other than what the samsaric experiences are. And so that leads a person to the study of true theology, God. And that is how a person comes out of this cyclic motions of samsara.
And cyclic is a very important word to understand between the Abrahamic faiths that we've looked at already, Judaism, Islam, Christianity are linear. As opposed to cyclical. We believe in a beginning, a middle, and an end. Act 1, Act 2, Act 3, the curtain comes down. The verse from Hebrews that says, it is appointed unto man once to die, and after that comes the judgment. God created the world. We're in the world now. There will be a conclusion to it. In Hinduism and in Buddhism, it's cyclical, that there is a continued, like you said, entrapment or falling back, the Atman or soul falling back into existence, that existence is something to be removed from. Existence is the problem. And so after this body wears out and I die, who I am or Atman is back into existence once again.
Correct.
Is that the way to... So we're dealing with, in other words, the word reincarnation, I suppose, is probably better known by a Western audience than...
Correct, that reincarnation, the reason why there is this cyclic view of life is because there is no according to the Hindu scriptures, it's not that the entire cycle is random. There is order to that cycle. And the experiences that a person goes through, those experiences are unique to that person because that particular individual has earned those experiences. Then how do I earn my experience? So this is where the doctrine of karma comes in.
Okay.
That as per my actions, so will be the fruits which I reap from my actions. If I do something good, then what I'm going to get back is going to be good. If I do something not so good, then chances are that I'm going to have to face those consequences. So that cycle is determined by that individual alone. We alone are the authors of our own destiny. And I alone, if I'm the author of my own destiny, then I alone can erase it. How do I erase it? By intelligently figuring out how have I created it. Walk back the same path which I walked. That is how I start erasing it. So thus the cyclic view in the Hindu philosophy.
And one of the things to understand is, of course, karma is understood by Hindus as... experiencing the consequences of good behavior, bad behavior in this life. But it's larger than that with the idea of reincarnation. One of the things, I suppose, the fuel that drives the process of reincarnation and being, you know, being thrown back into existence again after death is the fact that there are still debts to pay off. There's still behavior that needs to be paid for from previous existences.
Yeah.
So you really you come into this world already bearing the consequences of good karma and bad karma from previous existences.
Previous lives.
One of the reasons that I think this is, I think Americans are incurably optimistic, and Americans get a hold of the understanding of reincarnation, and all of a sudden it turns into something wonderful. I get a second chance to, you know, get life right, and that's not really the understanding. You mentioned we'll look at Buddhism next week, and I was studying. There was a PBS documentary on the Buddha that I saw recently, and one Buddhist scholar said reincarnation is, and he stopped and he said, well, imagine having to repeat junior high school over and over and over again. And I thought, what a perfect picture of what his reincarnation is, that you're back in existence because there is there are still things to work out from a previous existence.
Correct.
So again, you're still in the problem when you find yourself in existence.
Correct. When we are born into this world, we, you know, graduate from kindergarten, go to elementary, then go to middle school, go to high school, go to college, and, you know, years just go on by. And as the years go by, the human being evolves. But according to Hinduism, this life is also going through its own motion of evolution.
And this entire universe is going through its own motion. In other
motion,
words,
exactly.
The universe will collapse, be destroyed, a new one will come.
Exactly. So we have a universe which is a living entity, which is also marching along the beat of the time. In the universe is also various individuals which are marching along the beat of the time. And each one of them are in various phases of evolution.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but the gods and goddesses themselves, on the other side of things, the demons themselves, I mean, they're part of samsara as well. They're part of existence. They
also represent
karma.
The two qualities of good and evil. Mm-hmm. And there is always a point in time when good is high, evil is low, evil is high, good is low. Again, everything is in balance. Everything, right. That entire balance keeps on shifting as time goes on. So we have the devatas, the gods, and the asuras, the demons. They are also, at times, their power also keeps on shifting. In and through the various beings, their also individuality keeps on shifting. So when a being comes into this world, that being comes from whatever experiences which have shaped that being, it takes those experiences and then it starts to work on it. Someone may be physical age, may be 60, 70 years old, and there may be a young person, 16, 17 year old, who's spiritually far more evolved than the other one. Because the experiences that this person has brought shapes this person to think in a particular way, to interact in a particular way, to transact in this world in a particular way. And that is what determines what the karmic cycle and the karmic debt will be for that person, not only in this life, but in future life. Or, by doing proper deeds, can even wipe out lives to come. Can pull out of the entire cycle of samsara.
Yeah. Now, one of the things, again, to clarify, I think sometimes people in seeking to understand will take their categories from, you know, their particular religious background and try to transfer it over. And if you're trying to understand karma as judgment, it's not quite exactly that. It's not judgment in the sense of a god or a set of gods evaluating your life and going, okay, we're sending you back to get it right. I mean, there's no evaluation at that point. The law of karma is like, very much like a natural law, very much like the law of gravity. You jump off a 10-story building, there isn't some entity that evaluates whether or not you perhaps should survive that or should float away. I mean, it's just natural law. You're going
absolutely
to splat on the sidewalk. I mean, that's what happens. And again, coming a Christian worldview, a Christian background, for that matter, Judaism and Islam as well, would look upon judgment is an evaluation of a personal supreme being who is evaluating one's life and expressing pleasure or displeasure with it, and the law of karma it's always difficult to make an analogy to natural laws, but it's more of a natural law. There's not a supreme being sort of overseeing this process and personally deciding, I'm pleased with this, displeased with that. Is that the way of...
That's correct. The weight is primarily on our shoulders.
Yeah.
We determine our own destiny.
Winfried Corduan, who wrote the book Neighboring Faiths, which at least the title is where we got this from, said something I thought wonderful about this aspect of karma. And he said... you know, the central aspect that I want to highlight is that punishment in the literature of Western religions, that is Islam, Judaism, Christianity, is the result of the decree of a personal god. The operative image is that of a judge who imposes a sentence. The flip side of this idea is that a personal judge can also provide mercy or grace, something that the impersonal laws of nature cannot do. There is no gracious exemption from the law of gravity. In Hinduism and Buddhism, the results of violating a law are much more akin to breaking a law of nature. Is that a pretty good summary of Western religions and the law of karma?
Up to an extent, because there also is a path in Hinduism which is strictly on divine grace, that we have to earn that grace. But in order to earn that divine grace, we have to do karmas which will take us towards that divinity where grace will be walking your way.
Mm-hmm. Now the solution, the aim is moksha?
Moksha.
Moksha, that's the aim of and it's not so much salvation to something. Again, Christianity, for that matter, Islam and biblical Judaism would say we are saved to a paradise or a heaven, and sometimes laid out in very physical or explicit terms. Moksha is a picture of in Eastern religions of being saved, perhaps more accurately, from something instead of to something. I mean, am I right on that?
You're
the idea
absolutely
is,
right.
is to no longer re-enter into existence
Correct.
After death, but to get to a point where you're just no longer having to go through junior high ever again. You know,
exactly.
you are absorbed into the oneness of Brahman.
Absolutely. So moksha literally is samsara, freedom from the bondage of samsara is considered to be moksha. So freedom from, you're absolutely right in that terms.
Now, you began a moment ago to talk about some of the disciplines that are taught in Hinduism to be released from samsara and the reentry into existence and to achieve moksha. What are some yogas? What are some disciplines for that?
There are four steps that a person has to cross, and the fourth one is moksha. The first one is called dharma. Dharma, which people understand in Hinduism as a law of being. And when an individual lives in this world and transacts in this world according to one's own true nature, then that person is living, so to speak, a dharmic life or a righteous life with morals and ethics. Ethics is the subtler understanding of the inner instrument of mind and intellect, the expression of which is morality in this world. So at the physical level, you see an individual doing various acts, and they can be classified as moral or ignoble, noble or ignoble. But they have spring forth from the diving board of ethics, which is primarily a function of the inner instrument of mind and the intellect. In order for this mind and intellect to behave properly in this world, it has to be educated, and from childhood onwards, that dharmic way of living has to be taught.
Right.
With dharma, acquiring this righteous way of living, the person utilizes something known as artha. Artha meaning various objects available in this world. Pleasurable objects of this world without having attachment to it. When a person utilizes this world properly without developing too much attachment to it, that person slowly starts separating him or herself from the samsara. So the second goal is how is one's relationship with this world? That is determined by the objects, situations, and beings in one's life. The third one is artha. Artha is one's relationship with various things that one is attached to. Like, for example, relationship with money. How is one's relationship with that money? So when one tries to see one's relationship with the various objects in one's life, and if the relationship creates dependence, then the person is caught in samsara. So if dharma, artha, and then the third one, kamana, desires, if the desires are also blowing out of proportion, if the desires are not kept under control, then the person is caught in samsara. But if these three are taken care of, then that person will automatically enter the realm or the kingdom of moksha.
Moksha, which is the fourth.
Which is the fourth one.
There was a book out about 10 years ago called Finding God at Harvard, and some wonderful stories of Harvard scholars or Harvard professors. One was Krister Sersing. Don't know if you're familiar with him. He's from Trinidad. Was born to a priestly Hindu family. Graduated from Yale and then I think taught at Harvard for a while.
Correct.
Was perhaps still in Moscow. I'm not sure. Yeah. Teaching religion there. Yeah, he has a beautiful account, a beautiful story. I want to share a portion of it and then ask you about how Hindus understand conversion as he experienced, because he began to have a conversation with an Indian friend of his who was a Christian, began to read the Gospels as his friend encouraged him to. And he said, "What astounded me most was Jesus' claim to have power to forgive sins. I understood the fundamental principles of my religion well enough to know that within the Hindu scheme of things, there is no such thing as forgiveness for one's wrong actions. The law of karma, that whatever wrong we do, we'll have to pay for in some other life, rules out the idea of forgiveness. According to the law of karma, reincarnation is therefore necessary in order to pay for the sins of a previous life. But reincarnation is a necessary working out of the law of karma was never good news to me, even though I knew it undergirded the whole fabric of my religious and moral world." And he began to study the Gospels and ask, who was this Jesus who could break the bondage of karma, who said he had the power to forgive sins? I had to know. As I read his words in the Gospels, I thought he was speaking directly to me. It was as if he were telling me that he could actually come to me and forgive my sins, undo the past, loosen me from the terrors of death, break the bondage of karma, and make me truly free. One night after meditating on the account of the death and resurrection of Jesus in John's Gospel, I asked Jesus to forgive my sins, to set me free from the bondage of karma, and to become the Lord of my life. I had come to believe that he was the only one who could do that. Now, one of the reasons that I wanted to raise that story, I just thought it was a compelling story, but one of the questions I wanted to ask in light of that is the understanding of conversion. Is someone like Krister, is he less Indian if he decides, I'm not going to approach things from the Hindu way of understanding, I've decided to receive Jesus as my rescuer, who can break the process of karma for me, and if he comes into that conversion experience, does he lose his Indianness? The reason I'm asking this is perhaps you and I both know that there are perhaps some who one's religion and one's culture are so tightly intertwined that no one can really perceive of them remaining culturally an Indian or culturally a Middle Eastern man unless he maintains the religion that he was raised with as well. Is that an understanding in Hinduism that this is what it means to be Indian?
There is a very tight association with culture and religion in India.
And everywhere.
Very much so.
And everywhere, but especially, I would agree
especially
with you.
Especially in India. But one of the hallmarks of Hinduism is the true Catholic view of people's personal relationship with the Supreme Truth and the respect that, Indians have for religion and faith. This is a country where all faiths on this planet are practiced. We have, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Jainism, so many religions are there. And Indians have always lived in great harmony with people of various ethnicities, people of various religions, and especially religions. And having said that, we would embrace even Indians who follow various other faiths. There are so many Indians who are Muslims who are Christians. And that does not make them less of an Indian just because they follow some other faith. But in Hinduism, Hinduism does not believe in conversion. Hinduism believes that whichever faith we are born into is the right faith for us. There is a reason why a person has taken birth to a particular set of parents, particular city, particular community, particular state and nation. And if one adheres to that, that is the easiest way for that person to reach moksha. So Hindus do not believe in conversion. There are so many other people who come to Hinduism, and we said the very name of the religion is not Hinduism. Hinduism was a name given to us by others.
Right.
The actual name is Sanatan Dharma. Sanatan meaning eternal, Dharma meaning values. Anybody who values life, who values ethics and morality and lives by some type of doctrine that evolves that person day after day after day is Hindu.
A couple of more questions. I know we've got to come to an end. I'm very grateful for you to be with us tonight. One question I have, of course, many who are of Indian origin and who are practicing Hindus have been here for quite a long time. Others are immigrants, you know, first generation, second generation immigrants. How can we communicate welcome and make it an easier transition for folks who have immigrated from, well, predominantly India, to get sort of established and settled and feel welcome and sort of learn the ropes of American society? How can we help with that?
Well, Indians have always come to not just United States. Indians have left India and have gone to almost every single country in the world, and they felt right at home no matter wherever they go. And that is the very, you know, hallmark of this religion, that having endowed with that faith that truly the next door person is my neighbor, and I am going to treat this person with the same love, respect, dignity, and not just having belief in it, but truly practicing it. Indians have been successful in all parts of this world. So when Indians come to this country, you know, having been given the opportunity to come over here, Americans have always welcomed Indians over here, given the freedom to practice their religion over here. Just trying to get to know that individual, their culture, their food, their language, because, you know, most people think that Indians are Indians, but we come from a country which speaks 22 distinct languages.
Yeah.
We have, within India, we have so many different cultures. You know, if there's a family over here, I don't speak the same language that they do. Yet, we are all unified on the tenets of this philosophy, that there is one supreme being, and we both acknowledge the existence of that. If a person approaches an Indian with that belief, I think you have a friend.
I think that's a good way of, I think, bringing it to a conclusion at this point, because I think one of the things that we're wanting to do with this series is to understand our neighbors better and to communicate better with our neighbors as well. Would you thank Girish for being with us tonight, please?
Thank you.
I always want to end the each evening with this last question to each of our guests, including you. We are people of prayer. How may we pray for you and for the people who are special in your life? Is there anything we can lift up in prayer tonight?
Please pray for our entire congregation. We are in process of purchasing a new property and moving into a central location by Mopac and Parmer. So pray that all goes well with us.
All right. I want to do that. Before we conclude, I want to just mention some of the books that are on the table in the back, and let you know what's available on the resource table. John Piper has a book called The Let the Nations Be Glad, and what a basic introduction to world missions and understanding of that particular subject. I've got that back there. Winfried Corjan's book, Neighboring Faiths, is back there. And of course, that's the title of the book is where we got the title of our particular study, but this is a study of the major religions of the world from a Christian perspective, a very useful resource. I've mentioned this before, but one of the things that I've found in my study of studying world religions is it causes you to have maybe a deeper understanding, a deeper appreciation of your own faith. I imagine you said you began studying the Gospels, and it caused you to kind of go back to the Bhagavad Gita and try to understand more.
Right.
And so as questions arise regarding the Christian faith, those of you who are Christians who want a better grounding in that, those of you who maybe come from another world religion and want to understand more about Christianity, this is a plug. I've written a book called The Anchor Course, and it's available back there as well. And it will just be a basic introduction to the Christian faith. Well, like I said, I did want to close. We are people of prayer, and I did want to close with that. Heavenly Father, we are grateful for an opportunity to learn more about our neighbors. And I thank you for not only this evening, but the several hours that Girish and I have had an opportunity to learn more about each other and our understanding of our respective faiths. Girish, as I've asked him tonight to communicate something that we can pray for, he's mentioned something in specific. And our prayer tonight is that you would bless with provision, you would bless with understanding our Hindu friends and neighbors, and especially as this new organization is being put together, our prayer, Lord, is that you would reveal yourself beautifully and perfectly to every one of us in here. Lord, this is my prayer, and I lift it up in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you all for coming. Please feel free to come up and speak with Girish and me afterwards now.